This is going to be a significant disaster.
Great. Another disaster.
Well, I don't know why I came here tonight. I got the feeling that something ain't right.
No, it ain't.
I'm so scared in case I fall off my chair. And I'm wondering how I'll get down the stairs. Clowns to the left of me, jokers to the right. Here I am, stuck in the middle with you.
Yep.
Yes, I'm stuck.
From Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is the Bradcast, as heard on KPFK 90.7 FM in LA. In Oregon on 91.7 FM KYAQ on the Central Coast, 106.7 KSO in Cottage Grove. In Lancaster, Pennsylvania on 92.9 WLRI. In Maui, Hawaii on 88.5 KAKU. In Columbus, Ohio on WGRN 94.1. In Palinville, New York on 102.9 WLPP. In Grand Rapids, Michigan on WPRR. In New Orleans on 102.3 WHIV. In Washington, D.C. on 105.5 FM, and in Minneapolis, St. Paul on AM 950. KTNF, where I also stream coast to coast and around the globe every day on the Progressive Voices channel, Netroots Radio, Indie Media Weekly, FYI Nation, NicoleSandler.com, Radio Free Brooklyn, GDPR, Revolution 99, Deprogrammed Radio, Detour Talk, Radio Sputnik, and other fine affiliates across this planet. 5 days a week, I'm Brad Friedman, your friendly investigative blogger, journalist, troublemaker, muckraker, and all-around swell fellow, says me, from bradblog.com. Thank you very much for joining us today. I got to wonder if the National Guardsmen and women and those in the Coast Guard currently off the coasts of Texas and Louisiana who may need to be called in response to Hurricane Harvey, I got to wonder if the people that they will be helping or are helping will care whether those folks are transgendered or not. You suppose that would be something that they'd say, hey, before you give me this flood relief, National Guardsmen, Coast Guardsmen, drop your trousers.
Let's check and see if
or you know, or if the folks on the Gulf Coast right now facing havoc from Hurricane Harvey will be happy for that help, no matter what gender it is or isn't of the people who are helping them. We're going to talk about that hurricane in a moment, but that thought occurs to me today as Donald Trump's tweeted announcement a few weeks ago, taking the military itself by surprise with his announcement that he plans to bar all transgendered service members from serving their country in the armed services. As that series of tweets is now being crafted into actual policy that the military will be expected to carry out. Anyway, we'll speak momentarily with someone who worked on the previous policy under Barack Obama to lift the ban on transgender people serving openly in the armed forces. And about how Trump's Twitter-announced new policy is helping to wreak the very havoc that he claimed his new policy was meant to avoid. That's coming up momentarily. But it was almost 12 years ago to the day, Desi Doyen, when we were on the air in Crawford, Texas. I'm sure you remember it very well.
I do.
We were on the ground at Camp Casey. What had been called Camp Casey, named after Cindy Sheehan's son. He had been killed during an ambush in Iraq. She was demanding a meeting with George W. Bush, the president at the time, who was hiding away at his ranch nearby, in Crawford, Texas. There, she wanted an explanation as to what the noble purpose was that George W. Bush had said thousands of troops were being killed for, including her son, in Iraq. And it was on Sunday, August 28, 2005. We were on the ground there covering that huge protest in at Camp Casey in Crawford, Texas, that someone had sent. We were the only ones broadcasting pretty much around the clock at that point from on the ground. Someone had sent us an email including this warning from the National Weather Service, which I, at first, you'll recall, had refused to read it on air. We had to take a break because I thought it must have been fake news.
Yeah, you told me you thought, is this a hoax?
Right. We didn't use the word fake news back then.
No.
But it was really troubling. It said, and this was August 28, 2005, concerning Hurricane Katrina, devastating damage expected. A most powerful hurricane with unprecedented strength. Most of the area will be uninhabitable for weeks, perhaps longer. At least one half of well-constructed homes will have roof and floor failure. All gabled roofs will fail. Remember this?
Oh, yeah.
The majority of industrial buildings will become non-functional. All wood-framed low-rising apartment buildings will be destroyed. High-rise office and apartment buildings will sway to the point of total collapse. Airborne debris will be widespread. Persons, pets, and livestock exposed to the winds will face certain death. If struck, for power outages will last for weeks. Water shortages will make human suffering incredible by modern standards. This was the National Weather Service at the time. Livestock left exposed to the winds will be killed. It was an extraordinary statement that I thought must have been a hoax at the time. It seems so dire. Well, we're beginning to hear words like that again now describing Hurricane Harvey. 40 inches of rain is expected. Catastrophic storm surge flooding is expected. The combination of heavy rain and life-threatening, that's a quote, life-threatening storm surges, flooding, and strong winds could leave wide swaths of South Texas, quote, uninhabitable for weeks or months, once again, according to the National Weather Service in Houston. This is the type of language that has not been heard, frankly, since Hurricane Katrina, which, as you'll recall, left more than 1,800 people dead back in 2005. As it turns out, when Hurricane Katrina came ashore, there was fear that it would be a level 5, category 5 at the time.
Yes.
And it came ashore as just a category 1 when it finally came ashore. But it wasn't the winds that ended up killing all of those people. It was the flooding in New Orleans and the levees that gave way.
Yes, flooding is the major cause of death in storms like these. It's not necessarily the storm that causes the problem or even the high winds. As you note, I think it's 9 out of 10 of the deaths that are associated with large extreme storms like this are due to flooding.
And that's the big concern now. Yes, the winds as this comes ashore as a Category 3 is a huge concern. But this storm now is going to stick around for some 4 or 5 days, leading to some 40 inches of rain. Is that true?
Yes, yes. What happens is that right now, the way that it looks like is that the hurricane models are indicating that it's going to track along the coast, going eastward from Corpus Christi to Louisiana, and it's going to stall over that area of the southeast Texas coast for days, dumping all of its rain that it has been gathering up from this extra warm Gulf of Mexico. The Gulf of Mexico right now is one of the hottest spots on Earth in the ocean.
Extra warm. I wonder how it got so warm in the Gulf of Mexico.
Exactly. So that gives that hurricane a lot more energy, and it sucks up a lot more moisture. And so if it stalls, which is it is forecast to do, to stall, that it will just dump all that rain. And that's where we're getting the forecasts of up to maybe 40 inches of rain. Remember, that's 3.5 feet.
Yeah.
Of rain over 3 to 4 days as it stalls.
National Weather Service says rainfall of this magnitude will cause catastrophic and life-threatening flooding.
Yeah, what's different about this one, and what's shocking about it is I follow Andrew Friedman of Mashable. He's a meteorologist on Twitter. He's very clear, and he says we are all searching for superlatives here. There is no historical analog for this particular storm. There are similar storms that had similar features to them, but not all combined all at once like this one, especially the part where it's going to stall for a couple of days, and the the part where it's not going to move inland at all because of the nature of the jet stream and the nature of how our weather patterns are changing, it's not going to move inland like a normal storm. That's why it's going to stall right there and continue to travel and continue to dump its rain. But that means that you'll be getting a boatload of rain inland, but you'll also have the storm surge from the ocean. So that means that all that rain that's landing is going to want to go out to the ocean on the watershed, want to drain out to the ocean. But because of the high winds of the hurricane and because of the storm surge, which is projected to be 12 feet in some areas, that's going to be pushing that drainage back inland. So it won't have a place to go.
And we are having, since you mentioned that these changing weather patterns, we are about to have yet another record heat wave here in California. And it is, in fact, that heat wave coming into California and the West Coast that is helping to block this storm from moving inland and dissipating.
Yeah.
And is it possible then that this storm could, with some of the computer models show that it could loop out?
Yeah, that's the extra worst part about it, is that could push the Hurricane Harvey as it tracks along the coast. It could push it back out, potentially, into the Gulf of Mexico, where it could reform, re-energize, and pick up some more rain, and then hit again as a second landfall, again projected to be maybe even a Category 2 or 3 again, into Houston just a couple of days later. So that can be even worse than the projections already are.
And we talked about in our latest Green News report, we had talked about the concerns in New Orleans, particularly because their pumping system is down, even if it gets hit there again to some extent, and the levees, if they hold and everything else, there are still concerns about flooding in places like New Orleans?
Yes, they had a catastrophic rain event just a couple of weeks ago, and they're still recovering from that. And they're not going to be able to handle much rain. They're going to potentially evacuate the city if it looks like they might get significant amounts of rain. You know, we're talking about these areas getting a year's worth of rain in just 2 or 3 days.
You know, this is stuff that, Des, you, of course, have been warning about on the Green News Report for I don't know how many years now, pushing a decade at this point. So you know this issue very well, but also you know this area very well.
Yes, my family is from this area.
Yeah, and of course, I always make fun of Texas and blame you for everything bad that goes on in Texas. But your family is from Texas. You spent a lot of time down in Galveston growing up.
Yes.
You've spoken or you heard from some of your family members. First, are they doing okay there? Are they evacuating the area?
At the moment, no. They're not evacuating, but they're also no longer on the coast. We no longer have family in Galveston anymore. Mm. My family has been in the Texas Gulf Coast area for over a century, and my great-grandfather and my great-grandmother on both sides of my family both survived the catastrophic 1900 storm in Galveston that was the worst natural disaster ever to hit U.S. history. 6,000 estimated people died because of the storm surge. My mom tells stories about evacuating for hurricanes, the time that they didn't when she was a little girl, and the house literally blowing down behind them as they evacuated the house and the house collapsed behind them. You know, we have such stories like that. Nobody really lives on the coast anymore because of those stories. So they're all okay now, and they've got all their water ready to go. They're all ready to hunker down, and they're outside, luckily, outside the areas of considered to be flood warnings.
But some near Houston, which is expected to face some pretty bad
Yes, that if it hits again, then that could be a problem.
And right now, a new study is an estimate, at least from this group CoreLogic, says that Hurricane Harvey could leave behind some $40 billion worth of damage, with about 230,000 homes on the Texas coast in the path of that storm. And that reconstruction of those homes could reach $40 billion. You know, we talk a lot about, or we hear from, you know, Republicans talking about, well, even if global warming is going on and we barely think it's going on, even if it's going on, oh, it's a totally natural thing. And even if it isn't natural, even if it's man-made, still, we can't afford to do anything about it. It's too expensive to do anything about it. And then, You've got storms like this, which could cost $40 billion. And this estimate, by the way, had to do with just the winds. I don't even think it spoke about the flooding that could occur.
Yes.
Yeah, all over. You could have $20 billion worth of damage in Houston alone. The time and the resources we say saying that we don't have the time or the resources to do something about this is costing us billions year after year in these floods and these storms. Which is it, my imagination, or are these things getting worse as far as rainfall specifically?
Yes.
Between Superstorm Sandy, what we're looking at now. Yeah.
You are not wrong about this. NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, did a study recently in the last couple of years where mm-hmm. they noted that in different parts of the country, rainfall has become more intense and the frequency of heavy rainfall events has also increased. I think in some areas of the country in the Northeast, intense rainfall events have increased by 71%, and the same thing down in Texas, about 67%. And specifically for the Houston area, NOAA finds that heaviest rainfall days have increased by 167%.
Wow.
Yes. So this is a big deal, and it seems like it's a mistake that we continue to make over and over again as a country. Because two things to keep in mind. The National Flood Insurance Program, which is why the federal government had to take over flood insurance, because insurance companies said, we're done. We're not going to pay for this anymore. The National Flood Insurance Program is already over budget. It has been requesting additional funding from Congress for years now because we have so many of these catastrophic extreme rainfall events that they've pretty much depleted the program. We have lots of repeat properties that require continual and repeated flood insurance claims. Mm. But the other thing that they're not really talking about right now, because they're dealing with evacuations, is the pollution. You know, the Gulf Coast area is responsible for about 25 to 30% of the nation's refining capacity. Mm-hmm. So the refiners are going to be flooded. And when they're flooded, we're talking about chemicals from the oil industry, toxic chemicals that are going to be going into this flooding that are going to be there. It's also probably going to flood the sewage treatment systems of these areas as well.
And there is no small amount of irony here that we have so many oil and gas refineries down on the Gulf Coast oil platforms that have to be shut down here. No small amount of irony that the very people, the very industry that is helping to feed these new storms are the ones that are now getting hit, that are now going to, as you suggest, cause more and more pollution if these refineries flood out.
And they're going to be flooded for days, if not weeks.
And the additional irony is, this is great for them. Oil prices are going to shoot up in the wake of this.
Retail gas prices have already shot up about 10, 15 cents a gallon, depending on where you are, and it will affect nationwide supplies. Because, again, this is a third of the nation's refining capacity. This is where our gasoline comes from.
This is fantastic. What a gig. You cause the problem, and then you profit from it.
Well, there you go.
And by the way, we've got, speaking of problems, Donald Trump. He has appointed a FEMA director,
yes.
But apparently there is nobody appointed yet at NOAA and
right. So Brock Herkins, Long,
yeah.
Brock Long is the new FEMA director
right.
for the Trump administration. The good news is he is a well-respected, seasoned emergency management professional, as far as I understand it. So people seem to be comforted by that fact. But you're right, the Trump administration only has acting directors in positions at the Department of Homeland Security, at NOAA, at the U.S. Geological Survey, only an acting director at the National Hurricane Center, and there is no science advisor currently at the White House.
I will say, to a certain extent, I may be somewhat comforted by that, in that these acting directors, I think, are usually career officials
yeah.
who understand the problem, who have been there, who are not the heck of a job Michael Brown type characters. So maybe there's some people who, though they're not permanent appointees, they actually know what they're doing. So maybe we'll find out. Maybe we can take some comfort from that. Okay, quick break here, and we are back with Donald Trump's. Boy, you know, do we really need this sort of thing right now with all of this, with all that the nation is really facing? Donald Trump's latest completely uncalled for crisis being forced upon our nation's military and its members and its families. That story's next on the broadcast. I'm Brad Friedman. Don't go away.
Right, right. You're bloody well right. You got a bloody right to say. Right, you're bloody well right. You know you got a right to say.
You used to. Welcome back to the broadcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. On Thursday, Democratic Senator Tammy Duckworth of Illinois harshly criticized President Donald Trump's announced ban on letting transgender individuals serve in the U.S. military. She said, "When I was bleeding to death in my Black Hawk helicopter after I was shot down, I didn't care if the American troops risking their lives to help save me were gay, straight, transgender, black, white, or brown." Duckworth is a U.S. Army veteran who lost both of her legs in the Iraq War, and she said in a statement, "All that mattered was that they didn't leave me behind." The Wall Street Journal reported on Wednesday night that the White House was prepared to send the Pentagon guidance on how to implement Trump's Twitter-announced ban on transgender service members. Duckworth said that such a ban would harm our military readiness. She called on Democratic and Republican lawmakers to enact legislation that prevents it from taking effect if Trump continues to push this policy. She said, "If you are willing to risk your life for our country and you can do the job, you should be able to serve, no matter your gender identity or sexual orientation. Anything else is not just discriminatory, it is disruptive to our military and it is counterproductive to our national security." On Wednesday, the Wall Street Journal's Gordon Lubald reported that the White House is expected to send this guidance to the Pentagon in the coming days on how to implement this new administration ban on transgender people in the military. They will be issuing a policy that will allow Defense Secretary Jim Mattis, apparently, to consider a service member's ability to deploy in deciding whether to kick them out of the military or not. The White House memo also directs the Pentagon to deny admittance to transgender individuals and to stop spending on medical treatment regimens for those currently serving, according to U.S. officials familiar with the document. It's a 2.5-page memo that gives Mattis 6 months to prepare to fully implement this new ban. Mattis, under this new policy, is expected to consider what is described as deployability, the ability to serve in a war zone, participate in exercises, or live for months on a ship as the primary legal means to decide whether to separate service members from the military. The policy, of course, was announced by Donald Trump in a series of tweets late last month, which reportedly took even the commanders of all of the military branches by complete surprise. The tweets had indicated his intention to restore a ban on open transgender service that had been lifted last year under former President Barack Obama, in a move that also provided for military medical care for the condition known as gender dysphoria, as recognized by the American Psychiatric Association as a medical issue. Sue Fulton, the former president of SPARTA, a military organization for lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender people that advocates for open service, is quoted by the journal as saying that transgender people are just as deployable as other service members who may undergo procedures when they are at home base, just as other service members schedule shoulder surgery or gallbladder surgery. Pentagon officials have been awaiting policy guidance from this White House since Trump's July tweets. The move by Obama last year was among a series of steps toward opening the military to larger segments of the U.S. population, including rescinding the Don't Ask, Don't Tell prohibition against gays serving openly and opening most combat jobs to women. Yet in his tweets in late July, Trump agreed with so-called conservative lawmakers who wanted to backtrack on those Obama policies. Trump said the United States government will not accept or allow transgender individuals to serve in any capacity in the U.S. military. He said our military must be focused on decisive and overwhelming victory and cannot be burdened with the tremendous medical costs and disruptions that transgender in the military would entail. Estimates of how many transgender service members are openly serving in the military range from around 1,300 to around 6,600, according to a RAND Corporation study that was commissioned by the Pentagon. Not all of them seek treatment for gender dysphoria, according to the study. And defense officials have been perplexed on how they can legally or morally justify separating open transgender service members from the service, particularly those who were invited in, who were invited to identify themselves as openly transgendered. That RAND report concluded that the cost of treating transgender members is anywhere between $2.5 million to $8.5 million a year. Compare that to the total military health care expenditures, currently $6.2 billion per year as of 2014. As advocates such as trans veterans have noted, the cost of trans military members, their health care is one one-thousandth of a percent of the Department of Defense annual spending. Over at Vote Vets, the nation's largest progressive group of veterans, they issued a statement in reply to Trump's original Twitter announcement last month, saying that our professional military, implying that they simply cannot handle diversity in the force, is an insult. For those who have served, transgender service is not a problem, Will Fisher said, the director at Vote Vets. In fact, it allows the best into our military, and it is an asset, he said. They went and Vote Vets took a poll of 1,000 voters released this week, finding that a vast majority of voters from all parties, some 69%, do not support this ban. And they agree with the statement that if someone can do the job, they should be able to serve. That result was shared by majorities of both Democrats and Republicans, as well as independents. 86% of Democrats agree, 69% of independents agree, and even 48% of Republicans agree. That outnumbers just 39% of Republicans who'd prefer a ban on transgender service members. And I guess presumably kick out those who are already open and honorably serving. Vote Vets says there is no reason for a transgender ban. Military isn't asking for it. Americans don't want it. This is about Trump embrace of hate, say Vote Vets, period. Joining us now is Sue Fulton. She was quoted in that Wall Street Journal article. She is a 1980 West Point graduate, a member of the first co-ed class at West Point. She was commissioned in the Army, served as a platoon leader and company commander in Germany. She eventually attained the rank of captain. She's a founding member of OutServe, an advocacy group for LGBT soldiers. And she's a past president of Sparta, which was founded in 2013 as an association advocating for lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender people who currently serve or have served in the U.S. Armed Forces and their families. Sue Fulton, welcome to the broadcast.
Thank you so much, Brad.
Really appreciate you joining us today. Before we talk about this new policy being reported recently by the Wall Street Journal, as I understand, your organization, Sparta, worked with the previous administration on the original policy that had lifted the ban on transgender people in the military last year. Am I right about that?
That's correct. And to be more precise, we worked directly with the Pentagon to develop a good policy, and our role in that was to be a resource, mm-hmm. an information resource, pulling together documents that had been promulgated by police departments and fire departments across the U.S. that have incorporated transgender people, as well as militaries around the globe that include transgender people, and the State Department and Department of Labor that had policies to integrate transgender people. And there were a lot of different approaches, but there is across the board, all of these organizations have been successful integrating transgender people into their work. And this work is analogous to much of what the U.S. Armed Forces do.
Was that process, how long did that process take to pull together all those stakeholders and opinions and reports and everything else before the policy actually was announced by the Pentagon?
Well, we spent, as an organization, we spent about 6 months, and I'm indebted to Bryn Tannehill, who's a Annapolis grad, former Navy Lieutenant Commander, Allison Robinson, who's a West Point grad, former Army Captain. We pulled this information together to provide, it ended up being like a 142-page document that we provided to the Pentagon in support of their information gathering. The Pentagon itself studied this this issue for more than a year, 10 months specifically with a working group that was focused on answering the questions of readiness and cost that ironically are being raised by the president after, I imagine, no study at all. And that's what's interesting about this, if not infuriating, is that the Pentagon studied this in detail. They brought in people, and listen, we were an advocacy group saying, look, it is impairing readiness to keep transgender people in the closet, if you will, to say to them, not only, you know, are you continuing to bear the burden of service, but you have to bear the additional burden that you're not allowed to come out, you're not allowed to get your necessary health care. So we provided that information from one side, but to be fair, as always, Department of Defense sought information from all sides of this discussion. They sought subject matter expertise from across the country, not just from military sources, but non-military sources. So they did not make this decision to open transgender service willy-nilly. They made it based on their judgment about military readiness. And that's as it should be. I hear people telling me, well, this should be about readiness. And the answer is, this is absolutely about readiness. This is about having the strongest force, strongest, most effective military force that we can muster to protect and defend the interests of the United States. And as part of that, the Pentagon has determined that allowing transgender people to serve, to keeping that talent within the armed forces and continuing to recruit talent from as broad a pool as possible is right, is the best thing to create this strongest possible force. And that decision was made carefully. Now that decision is being overthrown based on no evidence. And in fact, based on saying that the evidence that the Pentagon itself uncovered and determined to be accurate was somehow, should somehow be thrown out the window.
And that's what I was trying to, that's why I wanted to ask about that previous policy, because it wasn't as if the Pentagon was not dragged kicking and screaming towards this policy. They looked at it, they took some time looking at it, and they found that this was an event, they eventually came to the conclusion that this would improve readiness. This was something that was good. It was not something that was forced upon them, correct?
That's absolutely correct. In fact, I would point to the fact that they delayed one piece of the policy, and that was accessions, and it was entirely focused on how long should you be stable in your target gender before you're allowed to enlist. So as a civilian, when you enlist in the armed forces, like, what is that period of time you need to be stable so that you can be successful in completing basic training? And there was a disagreement among the services, and so they said, okay, let's keep this one piece. Let's do 6 months more research. Let's just take another look at this, another go-around on this piece, and then come back on July 1, and hopefully at that point the services will have come to a consensus. Well, as you may know, by that time, you know, Secretary Mattis had come on and wanted, and you know, he's catching up on some of these issues, and he wanted to extend that period of time. So that piece of the policy was never finalized and now is just thrown out the window again. But I think it actually shows that there was such attention to the detail of this, to getting this right, that they weren't afraid to say, all right, let's take a little more time with this one piece. And the reality is, it wasn't that they didn't want to bring anybody in. In fact, there was never a disagreement. Unfortunately, there was never a disagreement on bringing in people from ROTC or the academies, but because they're an accessions point, they were caught up in this. But it was just a matter of, okay, what's this, how many months are we talking about? What is it, 6 months, or is it 12 months, or is it 18 months?
Mm-hmm.
And that was the disagreement. This was done so intentionally and so deliberately and with such care to the idea of how do we maintain and improve readiness. What is the policy that brings us to the strongest possible force? And that's why the president's actions are absurd.
And yeah, we have a series of tweets and what are we, about 3 weeks of discussion that seems to have taken place behind closed doors. I don't know that anybody was involved in them from the various stakeholders, and a leak of a 2.5-page memo, and not even a leak of the actual memo, as I understand it, but people who have seen the memo explaining what it is. And now under this new policy, if Wall Street Journal has it correct, they are considering what they call deployability, and that is to be the measure for whether a transgendered U.S. troop can continue to serve. Now, when I hear that, Sue Fulton, well, I guess my question is, you know about this stuff far better than I do. What does deployability mean? Isn't deployability already a consideration for all service members, or does that put some sort of special pressure only onto transgendered service members?
Look, deployments are a fact of life, a way of life in the U.S. military. And the reality is transgender people are no less deployable than anybody else. We have, you know, yes, there are transgender people who may choose to have one or more procedures.
Mm-hmm.
But in fact, the recovery time is relatively quick. You're talking about a population that's young and healthy. Let me give you an example. And first let me say that the average transgender person would undergo maybe one procedure.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? Not every person needs it, not every person finds it medically necessary to complete, you know, a whole suite of, you know, facial feminization surgery, trachea shape, any number of possible procedures.
Mm-hmm.
But that's a medical determination that's made between the medical team and the individual. But just as an example of the extremes, we have an infantry NCO that's actually undergone three procedures and has been non-deployable for a total of 30 days.
Mm.
Because that NCO is fit, is healthy, and schedules these so they do not interfere with deployments, schedule these so that they're in conjunction with their leave time. Listen, we've got a young officer who has had, this is the only person that we have in Sparta. We have 600 transgender Americans who are actively serving in the United States Armed Forces, and we have one person who has undergone four procedures while they're on active duty. And that officer has been non-deployable for less than 3 months.
Right.
Has never missed a deployment with her unit, has deployed remotely in the jungles of Malaysia in addition to standard deployments to Iraq and Afghanistan, and has performed so well she was selected for company command after her transition. Deployment is not a bar to transgender people, and I think this mention of deployability is a red herring to suggest that transgender people impact readiness for some reason that they're non-deployable. I've already seen some absolutely bogus articles from the extreme right wing about being non-deployable for a year at a time. It just doesn't happen. And we know that we have had people serving openly for over a year, have undergone procedures while they're on active duty, and just typically they have 3 weeks where they're non-deployable. 3 weeks. That's more than your non-deployability for a shoulder surgery or a knee surgery, which are very common.
Yeah, and I mean, as I'm reading this, as I was reading the report in the Wall Street Journal, they're talking about, quote, the ability to serve in a war zone, to participate in exercises, or live for months on a ship, and that this would be used as the primary legal means to decide whether to separate service members from the military. You'll recall this better than me, Sue Fulton, but it seems like that's the exact type of language that we used to hear when considering whether women were worthy of serving in the military and in combat. I remember Newt Gingrich talking about, oh, they can't live in foxholes for days at a time. That's what it sounds like to me, sort of the same old arguments that we've heard and that have been dispelled when it comes to women serving, when it comes to, gay members serving. Am I right? Is this sort of just the same old nonsense?
It's absolute nonsense. Look, Sparta, we have members who are in transition or transitioned, who are right now in Afghanistan, in Iraq, on ships, on subs. We've had people who were in the process of transitioning, mm-hmm. right, which is the time it's supposedly, oh, well, you're non-deployable for your time. They're in the process of transition in Afghanistan, on submarines, mm-hmm. where you're underway for 6 months at a time. We've had that experience. The military's had that experience, which is why they haven't raised this as an issue. What's interesting is you said, you know, supposedly they've seen this 2.5-page memo. Actually, to be clear, no one outside of the White House that we've been able to find, including the reporters, has seen the 2.5-page memo. They've been briefed on it. And the other interesting thing is they have floated straw men mm-hmm. about what this policy was going to be before. And in the past it was, well, because of the extreme cost. And as you remember, that was shortly after the tweet there where cost was brought up.
Right.
And it was just knocked down because it's such a tiny percentage. And in fact, what I like to point out to people, because I don't want to compare it to other treatments, because frankly, service members deserve medically necessary care, mm-hmm. period. That's our contract with our service members. Okay. But here's an example. Here's a comparison.
Yeah.
The cost to train replacements for just two of our transgender military officers mm-hmm. would pay for transgender health care for the entire force.
Oh, man.
For the entire force. And they're talking about displacing thousands.
So
of transgender service members who are currently on duty.
Yeah, and that kind of brings me to my next point is, what kind of turmoil is this now causing among LGBT members and veterans, but, you know, particularly in the active military? Isn't this the very type of disruption to our service members and their mission? That isn't that the very thing that Trump sort of claimed he was trying to avoid by implementing this ban in the first place? What are you hearing from folks who are still serving about this? I mean, this must be unbelievably upsetting to sort of wait to hear whether you're going to be tossed out of the military for something that you've, been welcomed into the military for more than a year now.
Well, it's tough. I mean, one thing I will say is you have to keep in mind that someone who is not only serving in our U.S. military, who's raised their right hand and volunteered life and limb in service of this country, but also is an openly out transgender person,
mm-hmm.
those individuals have more courage than you and me. Yeah. And I see it every day.
Mm-hmm.
But what I would call your attention to is not just what they and their families are undergoing, but what their units are going through right now.
Mm.
The day of the tweets, we checked in with everybody, you know, what's going on, and over they told us, my sergeant came to me, my CO came to me, my buddies came to me. They pulled the whole company together to say, we don't accept policy through a tweet. We have your back. We want you to fight this. You belong here. That was over and over the message they got from their units. And why? Because of something, ironically, that the president himself said, that when you serve, remember, these folks have been serving openly for over a year, and some of them longer than that within their units. When you serve and you go through these crucible experiences where you have to have each other's back,
mm-hmm.
You are bonded together. And it's not about whether the person next to you is black, white, brown, whatever color, whatever race, whatever religion, whatever ethnicity, whatever gender, whatever sexual orientation, whatever gender identity. That is your brother. That is your sister. And there is a bond there that can't be broken. And we are seeing that as one of our biggest concerns, that you're disrupting the entire unit. When you pull out the commander, or you pull out the drill sergeant, the pilot, the doctor, the Marine, the special forces operator from a team, and send them home for no reason other than we just don't like your kind anymore, that disrupts the entire unit. And that's the impact on the mission that I believe the senior military leaders are most concerned with, and rightly so.
Is setting aside for just one moment the issue of transgender, there was a similar amount of, well, actually much more hand-wringing for many years regarding open service by gays and lesbians until that policy was finally lifted under President Obama. To your knowledge, have there been any repercussions, any problems with that policy since it was implemented that might have somehow justified all of the years of hand-wringing and concern about it, or has it gone pretty smoothly?
You know, everyone's hope following the repeal of Don't Ask, Don't Tell is that problems would be minimal. Problems have been zero. It is widely considered. The repeal of Don't Ask, Don't Tell is widely considered by the Pentagon and people in the force to be an unqualified success. In fact, to quote somebody else, a big nothing burger.
Yes.
That it was a long time coming, should have been done a lot earlier. And to be fair, I have to say that this has probably helped in the integration of transgender service members, because people tried to resurrect the same horror stories about unit cohesion and what about the bathrooms. And it's all nonsense. What drives unit cohesion, the cohesion that counts, which is task cohesion, working together to accomplish the mission, what drives that are different skills pulling together to solve one problem. And our transgender service members have been key to that. And the other horror story that always comes up is showers and bathrooms, and it came up in Don't Ask, Don't Tell. And there has been zero issue. And part of that is, people don't understand that the lack of privacy is pretty extensive. What you learn downrange, I mean, men and women are in very close quarters, and you learn to manage your own privacy. Troops are very ingenious about figuring out, you know, where to put up a curtain and how to protect your own individual privacy and how to take care of yourself and then get on with a mission. They have to be. They're in remote locations, men, women, gay, straight, transgender, and they figure it out. It's not a problem. And so, I think we learned a lot from Don't Ask, Don't Tell that's applicable now.
This seems just, frankly, my opinion, I don't know if you share it or not, but kind of insulting to the military, this entire matter. Last question here, and you can respond to that as well if you like. But if the military is not even calling for this, if the American people are not even calling for this, as that VoteVet poll finds, what's going on here? Why is this happening at all, Sue Fulton?
Yeah, and let me just put a plug in. VoteVets is an outstanding organization. We've known those folks for a long time, and they stand up for veterans in a unique way, trying to get veterans in elected office, which I think would be good for the whole country. Listen, near as we can tell, here's what we've seen with this president. He is highly influenced by the people around him. In this case, it seems by a number of accounts that this came from partly from conservative members of Congress, but mostly from Vice President Mike Pence. Mike Pence is infamous for his stance that basically LGBT people should not be considered full citizens. He took away rights of LGBT people in Indiana until he was shut down. And best we understand it, this was him going to the president and saying, you know, he wanted this done, and there was some discussion that ended up with the tweets. But again, this is the president being influenced by someone around him who sold him hard on an idea, and so he just did it. You know, it's unfortunate that part of the reason that we can't rely on consistency from this commander-in-chief is that he's so easily influenced by people around him. And that's I think, what happened here. Meanwhile, you know, this may make political points with his ever-shrinking base, but he's interfering with the Pentagon's ability to get the job done, to accomplish the mission. And that should be a concern to everyone.
It sure should. Sue Fulton, past president of Sparta, which you can get more information on at spartapride.org. And you can follow them on the Twitters at Sparta_pride. You can also follow Sue on the Twitters at Sue Fulton. Really appreciate you joining us here today, Sue. I think you're fantastic. And if you don't mind, we'll be pestering you again in the future to come on and talk about these and other related issues, no doubt.
Thank you so much, Brad. It's been a privilege.
Thank you. And for your service, both in the military and thereafter. All greatly appreciated. Okay, a quick break, and we're back with our few closing minutes here on the broadcast. I'm Brad Friedman. Don't touch that dial. Well, how's this for timing? Welcome back to the Bradcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. As we went off air, Des, breaking news from Fox. President Trump has ordered the military to stop admitting transgender individuals into the military.
Wow.
Sending guidance to the Pentagon on Friday that the White House wants implemented by March of 2018, according to Fox News. And as I'm reading this, some of the other new services are now confirming same. So going with Fox here, the president signed and transmitted his directive to the Department of Defense, including the Army, Navy, Air Force, as well as Department of Homeland Security, which oversees the Coast Guard, directs the Secretary of Defense and Secretary of Homeland Security to make the changes by March 23 of next year. So that's what, about 7 months? The directive reinstates the ban on military service for transgender individuals, halts military expenses on sexual reassignment surgery, except for those who have already begun medical procedures, implements criteria for whether transgender individuals already in the military should be allowed to continue to serve.
Wow.
A senior administration official said, in President Trump's judgment... What judgment? The previous administration failed to identify a sufficient basis to conclude that terminating longstanding policy and practice would not hinder military effectiveness, disrupt unit cohesion, and tax military resources. Boy, after that conversation with Sue Fulton, hearing that crap really kind of makes my blood boil.
Yeah, it's this is going to be another unnecessary, completely useless, and foolish attack on our military.
And they, cruel.
They know how to do this. Cruel. They're fine.
Cruel to the people who are involved here. Trump's direction to the Pentagon, Fox notes, comes on the same week that he stood before an audience of 2,000 service members at Fort Myer, Virginia, Monday, calling for unity, saying every person who puts on the uniform makes our nation proud. Trump said, they all come from across our land. They represent every race, ethnicity, and creed. Notice he didn't say anything about gender in that comment on
True.
Monday, did he?
No.
But they all pledge the same oath, fight for the same cause, and operate as one team with one shared sense of purpose, unless, of course, they are transgender, in which case they should get the hell out of our military, apparently. We don't need you here. Man,
It's ridiculously stupid. And one of the things that occurred to me while Sue was talking was that we could be taking somebody who could be the most brilliant military strategist of all time, but because they have this external quality that the Trump administration cannot deal with, cannot stand, then we cannot have that person who could be the most best person ever not serve in our military.
And that the military does not even want. The military does not want to get rid of these people.
Right.
As Sue Fulton made clear, just incredible. Well, other than Sue, all of my plans for today's show have been completely tossed asunder by the hurricane in the Gulf and by Donald Trump. So we'll return to those things maybe on our next thrilling episode. I guess we'll have to see what continues on with Harvey. Which, as my father's name, nobody's named Harvey. You never hear the name Harvey anymore other than 6 foot rabbits and my dad. And now Harvey is causing massive destruction across the South. Nice going, Dad. All right, we'll get out. We'll figure all of this out next time. Until then, my thanks to our producer, Desi Doyen, to Sue Fulton from SpartaPride.org, and to you for spending a portion of your day or night with us. It is greatly appreciated. You can download this show and any other anytime for free at bradblog.com. My great thanks to those of you who help us continue to do what we do here by becoming active supporters at bradblog.com/donate. Thank you very much for that. You can drop me email if you like. I'm bradcast@bradblog.com and on the Facebooks and the Twitters, where we hope you'll find, follow, and share us worldwide. I am simply The Brad Blog. That is it. Until we meet again, I'm Brad Friedman. Good luck, world.